We've all heard the phrase, that kind of thing doesn't happen in our town. But here on Midwest Murder, we will shatter that false reality. In fact, it happens more often than we know, and sometimes the details of the most horrific crimes that happen in our neighborhoods are lost in the back pages of newspapers, forgotten on our news channels, and eventually erased over time. We're here to talk about murder, diving into some of the most controversial cases in Midwest history. This show will not shy away from the morbid details of these horrific events and the often ugly truths behind them. What you will hear is a detailed timeline of events, perspectives from those closely involved, and analysis by experts. What you will feel is the darkness that surrounds each story, the innocence lost by the victims, and hopefully the justice that was ultimately delivered.
Joan Alanto.
Dawn Dugan Palumbo.
Oh, wow.
I threw the middle in there.
Wow.
Yeah, I did extra.
Oh, why didn't you just say Dawn Marie Dugan Palumbo? How about that?
No, that'd be four. Four is too many. Three's good. Oh, three works.
Okay, I heard three's a crowd, but okay. That's fine.
Three's an audience in some cases, too.
Happens.
We are back in the western star of North Dakota. That's right, the great city of Williston. We're damn glad to be here. Big thanks to River's Edge and all the wonderful people of this community for inviting us back. We'd also like to thank Sarah Schroeder of Remax Bach & Realty for sponsoring this episode of Midwest Murder. If you need to buy or sell residential, commercial property, or land, then you need Sarah Schroeder, a Williston native with more than a decade of experience in the real estate industry. As a managing broker of Williston and Watford City Remax Bach & Realty, she has a passion for helping people in their real estate journey. Contact Sarah today at 701-570-6434.
Oh, big cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Cheers, Sarah.
Thanks
we appreciate
for sponsoring
that
this episode and this event.
Thanks for getting down
cheers.
With that.
Cheers.
Hey man, sponsors make this podcast go round, as do the reviews. So a thanks to everyone who has rated and reviewed the podcast on iTunes. We like to give you guys a little shout out, and sometimes it pumps the tires, sometimes it deflates them. Today, Dawn, I'm wondering which way it's going to go. What are folks saying about Midwest Murder out there?
I gave you two good ones yesterday, so I hope you were kind to me today.
Sometimes it's not about me being kind to you. It's about the people being kind to us.
Sometimes you make me read the reviews that insult me, and so I'm insulting myself.
Yeah.
Basically.
I mean, you're insulting. When you're insulted, I'm insulted. So we're being insulted as a team.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a partnership
that's
here.
That's deep.
Yeah.
It's real deep.
Just breathe and read this next one.
Wow. A couple days ago, Jonah told me to just take a breath and calm down. So it's a little too soon.
I guess that was a moment.
I think it's a little too soon for those jokes yet.
Yeah, we're here.
Yeah. All right. Well, 10 Bears, 3221 gave us 5 stars. Amazing. Midwest Murder is great. Love the banter, the accents, and the ability to tell a story. I'm also a huge fan of Dawn throwing in relatable stories, too. Oh, thank you. Somebody who likes my shitty stories. There was recently a live show in my town, and that's what made me look it up. I've binged all the episodes now, and I'm a dedicated fan now. Come back to Williston, and here we are.
Here we are.
I love it.
Are you out there tonight? Are you there?
Are you there?
No?
No.
10 Bears, 3221. We're back. And you are not. I guess you don't love us as much as the review.
Right, so, but thank you.
Thanks
though.
For the 5 stars. We appreciate you. We'll see you in the future.
Spence 422 exclamation point also gave us 5 stars. Loving this from Oregon. Started listening from episode 1 to the very latest episode out. Absolutely love this podcast. Between this podcast, Kendall Ray, and Crime Junkies, I am hooked. Absolutely love how both of you give your input and no details are left out. Even in the harder to read cases, you never stray from detail. Truly riveting. Wahoo. Ooh. Thank you.
That gave me a little bit of the goosebumps right there.
The Jonah bumps.
Well, yeah. The Jonah bumps indeed. Just not holding back on the details. And again, the banters. And listen, I don't have an accent. How dare you?
I know. I always feel like I'm like, no. I mean, sometimes I do pronounce a long A, but I don't know. I think we do. I don't think it's...
We probably do.
Let's be self-aware there.
Yeah.
Okay.
This show is also brought to you in part by Midwest Memoirs. Listen, do you love the stories of your family? And do you want to be able to hear them forever? Like a podcast you can listen to with future generations? Then you need to contact Midwest Memoirs, because we're here to ensure those stories and the voices who tell them are never forgotten. Imagine hiring professionals to conduct a sort of 60 minutes-like interview that is the story of your grandma's life or your mom's or dad's or uncle's life. In a nutshell, that's kind of what Midwest Memoirs is doing. It's really special. And Don, I sleep better at night knowing that my Grandma Helen's stories will never be forgotten. That the grandchildren I'm in absolutely no hurry to have will someday know her voice and what she lived through 100 years before their time. You can find Midwest Memoirs on Facebook and Instagram.
And you know, I have the exact opposite. My grandma just passed, you know, about a month ago,
yeah.
And I don't have those stories. And so it's a very big deal, and it's one of my biggest regrets. So I think it goes both ways.
I agree completely. We've also recently lost something that we're pretty excited about.
Did you say
this
lost
is very
or launched?
New. Launched.
Yeah.
Launched.
Yeah.
Launched.
I have
probably
not lost
word.
Anything.
We have launched Club Midwest. We're inviting all of our Midwesties besties to join us, and it's kind of like a fan club. We call it Club Midwest. By signing up to be one of our besties for $10 a month, you get access to virtual recordings and host interactions, episodes up to 7 days earlier than release date, and entry into monthly merch giveaways. And we've also got some other exciting ideas of special cool things we can do to give back to our fans. And listen, Midwest Murder is independently produced. This is all that we do for a living. And so this stuff helps us pay the bills. It helps us keep going. And we're just looking for all the different ways we can give back for somebody who wants to kick in a little extra for Midwest Murder.
Yeah. When we order, you know, case files or anything like that, it comes out of our pocket. So when you help us, when you support us this way, we're able to give something back to you as a thank you. And yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah.
Club Midwest.
Club Midwest. You can find out more on our social media. Tonight, taking us back to 2010. In 2010, the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig explodes, killing 11 and causing the rig to sink. It was a massive discharge of oil into the Gulf of Mexico and an environmental disaster. And I think Mark Wahlberg was later in a movie about it. In 2010, the Affordable Care Act was passed by the United States Congress and signed into law by President Barack Obama. Toy Story 3, Iron Man 2, Inception, Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland were all released that year.
I refuse to watch Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, it was really good, though.
I can't. It creeps me out.
Yeah, aren't you like scared of Tim Burton movies or something?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's something about it.
Mm-hmm. Eminem released his 7th studio album, Recovery. It went on to become the worldwide best-selling album of 2010. And in the longest match in tennis history, American John Isner defeats Nicolas Mahut of France at Wimbledon after 11 hours and 5 minutes of play over 3 days.
I have played tennis most of my life, and that sounds horrific.
That's a lot of tennis.
Yeah.
Well, it's sitting through that 3 days of games, the same game.
Yeah.
Operation Iraqi Freedom ends with the last of the United States Brigade combat teams crossing the border to Kuwait. Bryan Cranston won an Emmy for his incredible performance as Walter White in Breaking Bad, one of the best series of all time.
Probably the only human who has not watched it is right here.
Oh, no.
I've not watched it. Mm-hmm.
You gotta check it out sometime. It's worth it. I plan to.
Yeah.
And panic caused by an escaped crocodile being smuggled aboard a domestic flight in Congo led to the crash of a commercial plane, killing 21 passengers and the crew.
I mean, I don't want to point out the obvious, but
smuggling crocodiles.
How did you not think that was going to go badly? I mean, for real. Like,
it's bad. The Walking Dead premiered, and I think it's still going. I don't know. I checked out about halfway through. The engagement between the British Prince William and Kate Middleton at Clarence House, London, dominating the airwaves that year. Rolling in the Deep by Adele. And with the second launch of the SpaceX Dragon, SpaceX becomes the first privately held company to successfully launch, orbit, and recover a spacecraft. All in 2010, the year our story takes place. We all live in the same world, but none of us perceive it the same way. Your blue might be my green. Your favorite sandwich is not my favorite sandwich, and your associations and connections are vastly different from everyone else's. When you see a tree, you might think, wow, that tree is so peaceful, or hey, I could build a tree fort, or hey, I kind of want to hug that wood. Whatever you think, it is entirely your own thought.
Before you get too deep into this, I mean, isn't blue just blue and green is green?
No. Okay. No, remember that handbag last year and people were going batshit on the internet over whether or not it was blue or green. And then you had some weirdos who thought it was purple.
It was like the
so
blue,
no, we don't like, see the, these
where
things the
dress
the same.
Looked blue and black, but it was like cream and yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Sorry. I was just really hung up on that. I was like, wait a second. Like, are we talking about like color blindness? Because I know that's different,
no.
But I will pump the brakes on the commentary already.
Your perception is reality and not all perceptions are equal. And luckily for humanity, we constantly seek connection despite those individual perceptions of reality. As a species, we can accommodate those thoughts I just mentioned, if only to keep all of us glued together behind some common bond. Sometimes, though, we run into perceptions that defy understanding, that frighten us by existing far off the beaten path of quote-unquote normal thought. Sometimes the people who hold these perceptions are unique and wild and challenging, like David Bowie. Other times, they're disconnected and cruel, inhuman, and illogical, like Matthew Hoffman. Hoffman was different in one of those undiagnosable in the 2000s sort of ways. And people were put off by his strange demeanor and dark yet seemingly harmless comments. During a bonfire, for instance, Hoffman stared at the fire and started talking in depth about how easy it would be to burn things you need to hide in a fire. Like you could burn your shoes if you wore them at a crime scene, or you could burn the clothes of people you killed. You could even burn bodies.
Now, I feel like in a room full of true crime people, that doesn't seem so weird. You know? Like we've had some crazy conversations on the way to and fro, but I suppose he's probably not a true crime fan. He's just randomly speaking.
Well, I'm guessing the bonfire goers were not true crime fans because Hoffman wasn't invited to many parties after that. And not that he cared. Hoffman spent most of his time outdoors. And he loved to hang out in forests or near trees or up them. He would regularly climb trees well after the acceptable tree climbing age. Once up in a tree, Hoffman would perch there like a vulture, barely moving. He even brought a hammock up the trees near his home in Ohio and would take naps suspended 20 or 30 feet above the miniature forest in his backyard.
Okay, I know that this guy is going to lose his shit eventually, and I know that this is, but...
That sounds kind of cool.
But
a little
bit. I mean, what's wrong with that? I like a hammock, and I mean, I've got some tree climbing friends.
The vulturing is a little weird. The hammock, maybe not.
Okay.
Before his odd tree napping and nefarious bonfire comments, Matthew Hoffman was little more than an eccentric child who grew into an oddball teen. He kept his head down in school, other than a rare moment when he and some friends decided to climb to the top of Lakeview High School in Mount Vernon and were collared by police. Compared to climbing trees and squatting in them for hours, this was relatively normal climbing fare for Hoffman. After graduating in 99, Hoffman studied electrical engineering before moving cross-country to the developing resort town of Steamboat Springs, Colorado. He found work as a plumber's assistant for a swanky set of condominiums, lived in a skeevy motel called the D-Bar K, and developed an antisocial streak that defies reason. Hoffman stole three large "Welcome to Steamboat Springs" signs from around the town and hid them in his motel room and in a crawl space under the hotel. And this minor bit of goofy mischief may have gone unnoticed if not for a fire in the condos where he worked. A fire that was swiftly determined to be arson. A fire that started in Unit 7 of the condos, the unit where Hoffman had last worked, installing a garbage disposal. And it was a fire that was obviously connected to Hoffman in some way. After all, Police found his fingerprints all over a recently stolen vehicle that belonged to the tenant of Unit 7, who was out of town at the time of the fire. This immediately made Hoffman a person of interest. When investigators tried to track him down at his motel room, they found out he moved back to Ohio immediately after the fire. That, plus the stolen signs found in his room and stuffed under the motel, made things pretty obvious. An officer called Hoffman and asked him about the signs. He said, Hoffman, with zero coaxing, that he had stolen them. He explained that he borrowed a coworker's pickup, but acted alone. And when asked why he did it, he said, quote, I wanted some souvenirs from Steamboat. Because the best souvenirs are the ones you leave behind in crawl spaces when you hastily skip town after setting fire to a condominium.
Seems normal.
Yeah, it's perfectly logical behavior. The officer informed him that he had until September 26th to return to Steamboat Springs and turn himself in. An arrest warrant would be issued on September 27th. A detective who overheard Hoffman's name mentioned that he was looking into the same guy regarding the arson case at Ridge Condominiums, that Hoffman had been the last plumber to service Unit 7 where the fire started. Hoffman showed up on September 26th, signed a waiver of his Miranda rights, and submitted to questioning. Again, he made no attempt to hide his guilt, giving a more detailed explanation of the friend who borrowed him the truck and the process removing the signs from their frames. Next, the detectives began questioning Hoffman about his former job and the units he serviced at Ridge Condominiums. He mentioned Unit 7 and said that he and his boss installed a garbage disposal. The detectives asked why his fingerprints were all over some of the boxes in a vehicle that was stolen from Unit 7's garage the night of the fire. Hoffman said that he moved some of the boxes and furniture to install the disposal. When the officers asked why he would have to move furniture in the garage to install a disposal in the kitchen, he just sat there, silently, not saying a word. Hoffman answered a few questions about the stolen car, and it quickly became apparent that he stole it and left it near the center of town before he departed for Ohio. Both officers could feel the charge in the room, so they asked Hoffman if he knew where this line of questioning was going. Hoffman threw his hands up and said lightheartedly, "Okay, you obviously got me." The officers grabbed the tape recorder and continued asking about various items that had been placed in the SUV. Hoffman confirmed that he had taken them and, in keeping with his penchant for openly stating everything, mentioned that he had stayed in Unit 7 five times over the couple weeks before the fire. He knew the tenant was going to be on vacation, so he set up shop in their condo, cooking meals, watching their cable TV, and using the jacuzzi.
Ew.
Oh.
That's so icky.
Yeah, ick. Mm. When asked why he burned the place down, he said, quote, I burned the place to cover up the crime because my fingerprints were all over the place. I couldn't have cleaned all the prints. I had no choice. I had to start the fire.
I mean, that seems like a really clear, logical way of thinking. Like, just set the place on fire. Yeah. Just burn this shit to the ground. Like, oh boy. Okay. So
yeah.
Maybe not playing with a full deck there is that,
well,
kind of?
If his deck is full, it's a fucking weird one. Let me tell you, he's not using the same cards as you and I. So yeah, in order to cover up the creepy but relatively minor crime of hanging out in someone's house and watching their cable TV when they're out of town, he committed arson.
So hold on. Nobody would have ever known.
No. They would have had no idea that he did that.
Which also makes it creepier. However, better because he didn't light their entire life on fire. I mean,
something. I don't know. Even at this early point, almost a decade before moving back to Ohio and committing some far more heinous crimes, Hoffman's odd reasoning and sketchy logic made him seem almost disconnected from human experience. He showed no signs of feeling guilty or upset, no signs of resignation or sadness. In fact, he made jokes with the officers as he confessed. When asked how he transported gas to the condo, he said, quote, "Oh, didn't you find the containers? There's always a lot of evidence after a fire. I used milk containers." Then he laughed, said he was kidding, and said he used regular plastic gas cans.
I usually have a pretty good idea of where something's going, you know, when you start out with one of your shows. I have no idea. I mean, I can assume.
But... Creepiest creep. So yeah. Why he would choose to lie about the most minor part of the crime was beyond the detectives, unlike anything they had ever seen. And it was like he didn't believe anyone would actually imprison him, as if arson didn't strike him as a particularly evil act. The detectives asked him if he was concerned about other tenants in the condos, and he said, "I know the fire alarm would warn them."
There's a major disconnect between, you know, any feelings of empathy whatsoever.
He doesn't understand that at all.
Like, human emotion is not for him.
Yeah. Well, shockingly enough, Don, that statement was not enough to exonerate him.
Sure.
Hoffman was charged with theft, burglary, and arson, and was held on a $25,000 bond. Detectives confirmed that he purchased two plastic gas cans at Walmart a month earlier. He used a credit card and was all over store cameras. When the detectives talked to the friend, quote unquote friend, from whom Hoffman borrowed the pickup he used to steal the signs, the friend said he never gave Hoffman permission to take his truck. Another charge was added to the rap sheet. While Hoffman was waiting in jail, he came to the conclusion, against his lawyer's advice, that he should plead guilty to all of the charges and hope for leniency from the judge. He prepared a statement that said, in part, that he now understood what he had done was wrong, and he realized that the number one thing in life is God. He said that God was, quote, "an omnivorous and omnipresent aspect of daily life." Now, as just a little vocabulary reminder, omnivorous means eats all kinds of foods. Okay. Hoffman's God is a hungry God.
Maybe he needs a hot dish. When you said omnivorous, I was like, wait, I mean, maybe I'm not remembering what the appropriate definition of
wait
that
a minute.
Is. It's like, huh, maybe I have that one wrong. Oh boy.
Well, let me tell you, Matthew Hoffman's omnivorous God.
Do you suppose that's similar to Jailhouse Jesus? Is Jailhouse Jesus omnivorous?
Oh my God, he must be. So his omnivorous God, along with a very unimpressed judge, sentenced him to 8 years in prison, of which he served six before returning to Ohio on probation. Upon release, he bounced from job to job before finding work as a tree trimmer, which was a dream position for him given his love of all things covered in bark. He even found a girlfriend. She and her son moved in with him after he bought a house for $37,500. Remember the days when real estate made sense? Hoffman was considered a decent guy in his neighborhood for a little while. He would play.
I really hope Sarah thought that was funny.
Yeah, we couldn't have planned that. Hoffman was considered a decent guy in his neighborhood for a little while. And he'd play games with the local kids, they'd watch movies, and he even gave them rides to various appointments. One woman was totally fine with Hoffman giving her 14-year-old daughter rides to movies and to school. Around late summer of 2010, something changed. Hoffman, normally not the smoothest marble in the bag, began to bother his neighbors with erratic behavior. For one thing, his dogs suddenly disappeared. There was no sign they ran away, and his girlfriend was silent about it. Of course, rumors ran wild what Hoffman might have done to them. And then, Dawn, there was the squirrel barbecue.
Was it like squirrel or was it the dogs?
Oh, buddy. No, you heard it right. It was squirrel. It was the squirrel barbecue.
I would prefer squirrel barbecue over squirrel,
which is actually dog barbecue. So that,
yeah,
maybe I'm taking it too dark. Already.
Yeah, you went. Okay, Hoffman set traps around his yard, caught squirrels, skinned them in the backyard, barbecued and ate them.
Well, if they're good enough for Uncle Eddie, they're good enough for Hoffman, I guess. Or Cousin Eddie, not Uncle Eddie. Cousin Eddie.
The weirdest part was that it was literally out of nowhere. At no point in his life had Hoffman ever done anything like this. That little move ended his hangout sessions with neighborhood kids. Also, the 14-year-old girl Hoffman would drive to the movies complained to her mother that the 30-year-old ex-con who she caught rides from was starting to get weird.
Okay, yeah.
He would take her on increasingly scenic routes home when he picked her up, and it made her nervous. She told her mother, and finally, her mother put the kibosh on the whole thing. Some might say that girl's mother should have put a stop to it before it ever happened. But we're not here to judge objectively awful parenting. We're here for murder. Luckily for that girl, Hoffman wasn't feeling murderous yet. But he was testing his limits. Though Hoffman had no history of violence, he suddenly started abusing his girlfriend, causing her to pull back from other people. Where once she was a gregarious, upbeat presence in the neighborhood, she retreated to the point that neighbors rarely saw her. Between the dogs, the squirrel, and the disappearing girlfriend, his once benign image in the neighborhood started to darken. Then, in October of 2010, Hoffman's girlfriend took her son and left him. She forgot a few things when she left because she was in a hurry, which is understandable. When she returned, Hoffman began shouting at her. Their argument escalated, and when she tried to leave, Hoffman pinned her up against a wall, pressed his forearm into her throat. She struggled and escaped, but he knocked her over a chair and tightened his hands around her throat, choking her. Hoffman's girlfriend filled out a police report, but decided not to press charges. There was something about this man that invited people to make the most illogical decisions around him. Hoffman's life began to spiral faster and faster. He lost his job as a tree trimmer because he lied about his level of experience, and he made his boss uncomfortable. Then, in early November, his electricity was shut off because of delinquent payment. All of this loss made for a potent hodgepodge of stress and anger. No work, no play. What was left for him to do? In true Hoffman fashion, he decided to spend most of his time in the trees behind his yard. He ran a tightrope between two trees and tried to learn to walk on it, to no avail. Then, he just squatted up in the tree branches like a stone gargoyle, unmoving for hours.
Okay, he obviously has a thing for trees, which is cool. But it's the part of not moving for hours that's where it takes it to another level, right?
Climbing trees, cool.
Right.
Sitting them
like
unmoving,
a gargoyle is another
fucking
story.
Creepy gargoyle.
Yeah. Yeah. That's where it crosses a line for me. I mean, I'm sticking up for him on the tree thing, like to a point, but the gargoyle perch, that's where it takes it to a different.
I'm waiting for like neighborhood kids to come and throw apples at him and knock him out of the tree or something, but this is not that kind of story. Hoffman had never really been capable of maintaining friendships, and he wasn't close to his family. In his isolation, he began to truly plumb the depths of his own psyche. Using a Sharpie, he scribbled cryptic drawings on the walls of one of his bathrooms, random animals, faceless people, and a large drawing of a balding man's head with a faucet coming out of his mouth.
So he's creative.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's artsy.
Yeah. And he's a collector. He collected leaves and collected more leaves and then collected even more leaves than that. Enough leaves to cover the floor of his office in his house to a depth of several feet. He then did the same in his basement. Then he stuffed hundreds and hundreds of grocery bags full of leaves and taped them to the wall of his bathroom, bags and all.
Okay.
It's like he was preparing a nest.
Ah. Oh. Well, now I know exactly where this is going and I don't like it.
But what is a nest without a mate?
Oh, no.
With nothing but time on his hands, Hoffman cruised the neighborhood. He noticed one house with a slightly like kinked garage door. It never closed all the way. The owner of the house, Tina Herman, knew about it, as did her boyfriend, Greg Borders. But Greg and Tina were splitting up. The garage door was the least of their concerns, especially given Mount Vernon's sleepy reputation and population, just a little over 35,000. Tina was only thinking about finding a new apartment and getting herself and her kids, 11-year-old Cody and 13-year-old Sarah, situated with as little fuss as possible. Tina had set up a date with her best friend, Stephanie Sprang, on November 10th, 2010. The two were going to look at apartments while Greg was working his job at a Target distribution center 3 hours away. Tina had to run some errands after the kids got on the bus for school, so the two were planning to meet at Tina's house around noon. The kids got on the bus, and Tina hopped in her Jeep to zip through her to-do list. She had a busy day. Watching the Jeep back out of the garage, hunching in a low stand of trees across the street, was Matthew Hoffman. He wore a long-sleeve camouflage shirt and was tucked into a sleeping bag he had carried out the night before when he began his stakeout of Tina and Greg's house. There is little evidence or testimony that explains why he chose Tina Herman, other than the broken garage door. And really, reasons are useless after the fact. But humans are pattern-seeking creatures, especially when faced with the extreme fringes of behavior. Given the gut-churning violence that followed, there is no logic that can be applied to the events of November 10th. As soon as Tina's car drove out of sight, Hoffman crossed the street, snuck under the garage door, and gloried in another clandestine visit to an unoccupied home. He familiarized himself with the layout of the house, wandered through the rooms, marked the exits. He carried a large knife in a sheath strapped around his waist and held a heavy blackjack sap in his hand.
What's a blackjack sap?
Like a blackjack sap beater. It's like a leather like beater in the end. Like it's like a flapjack, blackjack. There's a few different names for it.
Oh, okay.
Does that explain it?
I think so. Okay. I mean, I may have just smiled and nodded, but yeah, I think so. I'll look at it later.
Hoffman had the house to himself for about 2 hours. A few minutes past noon, Tina walked into her home, oblivious, carrying a few grocery bags, her mind on apartments and the end of her relationship. She never expected a furious man charging her, knife in hand, from inside the house. Hoffman clapped his hand over her mouth, thumped her with the blackjack, and dragged her to her bedroom. He stabbed Tina twice before he realized there was someone else in the house. Tina's best friend, Stephanie Sprang, had walked in the front door ready to go apartment hunting. Instead, she found Hoffman hunched over Tina, who was bleeding and semi-conscious. Hoffman leapt off Tina, grabbed Sprang, and dragged her to Sarah's room, where he viciously stabbed her twice in the chest, puncturing Stephanie Sprang's heart and lungs, killing her almost instantly. He continued to stab and stab. Blood sprayed across the walls and soaked the carpet. Satisfied, Hoffman returned to Tina's bedroom and proceeded to stab her repeatedly, at one point deeply slicing her across the abdomen, striking several organs. Both women were obviously dead. One thing he didn't anticipate was the family dog, who barked incessantly as he murdered the women. Hoffman picked up the miniature pincher, brought it to the bathroom, and killed it, dismembered it, and stuffed it into a garbage bag. Once he was done with the dog, Hoffman dragged both women's bodies into the bathroom, where he set about the bloody business of dismembering the bodies and bagging the mess with a roll of garbage bags he either brought or found in the house. There was blood everywhere. Pools and spray where each woman was stabbed. Streaks down the hallway carpet from where he dragged each corpse to the bathroom. And in the bathroom, the sink, toilet, bathtub, walls, and floor were all slick with blood and viscera. Whatever planning Hoffman had done beforehand, he didn't plan for the amount of time it took to cut up the women and the tiny dog. He was still in the bathroom working on bagging the various body parts when Cody and Sarah returned home from school. As soon as the kids walked in the door, they could tell something was off. Without fail, Tina greeted the kids when they got home from school. The silence in the house was deafening as both kids leaned over to remove their shoes. Right by the front rug where the kids usually left their shoes, a few drops of blood had soaked into the carpet. Cody and Sarah spotted the blood and yelled out a question into the still home. "Mom?" The kids barely had time to register the sound of footsteps barreling down the hallway before Hoffman was on them, covered in blood and brandishing the knife. Sarah and Cody broke in separate directions. Cody ran for the front door. Sarah dodged Hoffman and raced to her room. 11-year-old Cody, he didn't make it far. He was slain instantly by the first stab wound, then stabbed twice more before Hoffman turned his attention to Sarah. Sarah made it to her room and attempted to call for help on the home phone, but Hoffman kicked her door in and intercepted her. When it came time to stab the girl the way he had stabbed everyone else in the house, something stayed Hoffman's hand. He couldn't bring himself to kill her. And his reasons probably not worth thinking about too deeply. He cut a length of electrical cord from a fan in Sarah's room and tied her hands together. He gagged her with some fabric, then heaved her over his shoulder and carried her to the basement. Once there, he cut a length of rope from an old sled and tied Sarah's feet together. He also put a pillowcase over her head. Then Hoffman carried her back upstairs and laid her down in the kitchen. The pillowcase fell off Sarah's head, and Hoffman made no attempt to replace it. Sarah was then treated to a series of baffling noises coming from the bathroom as Hoffman chopped up Cody's body and bagged him up like his mother, her friend, and his dog. Every now and then, he would come back to the kitchen and grab some cleaning supplies, clomping in his boots through to the living room, and then go back to the bathroom. Sarah had no idea that Hoffman was transporting garbage bag after garbage bag full of the remains of her mother, her brother, her dog, and Stephanie Sprang into Sprang's Jeep, which he had pulled into the garage after killing the two women. Sarah laid on the ground in the kitchen, unable to wriggle free. There was no way of knowing where Hoffman was or when he might come back. Sarah laid there, bound, alone, wavering between a world of blind hope and dismal despair. What was taking Hoffman so long? Finally, sometime after sunset, Hoffman came to retrieve Sarah. He affixed a blindfold over her eyes and carried her to the garage, where he tossed her in the back of the Jeep and covered her with a blanket. Sarah could feel garbage bags piled around her, heavy and full. With his cargo secure and his hostage tied up in the car, Hoffman took a minute to walk around the house and dump motor oil on the blood. His plan was to come back and torch the place. For now, he had a lot of disposal to take care of.
Can we take a second, please?
Yes.
Because that's a lot.
It was around this time that Tina's friend, Valerie Haythorne, who was also her manager at the Dairy Queen where Tina worked, called the Knox County Sheriff's Office to let them know that Tina missed work. And it was something that Tina simply never did, especially not without calling or covering her shift. The sheriff's office sent a patrol car on a welfare check around 8 p.m. on the 10th. The house was dark and there was no car in the driveway. An officer knocked on the door, but no one answered. By this time, Hoffman and Sarah had already left in Stephanie Sprang's Jeep. Hoffman took the stolen Jeep on the scenic route to a place he knew well, a place he spotted during his short-lived gig as a tree trimmer. He swore to himself that no one would ever find a body where he planned to hide his four victims. And I say four because that dog counts. Once the car stopped, Hoffman checked on Sarah, told her to stay put because he'd be watching her. Then he walked off. Sarah took the opportunity to wriggle around and loosen the blindfold, which fell around her neck. She was indeed surrounded by garbage bags and covered with a blanket Hoffman found in her house. It didn't occur to Sarah what might be in the bags. She was thinking only of survival. Full fight or flight mode had switched on, and all external stimuli was filtered through that. She wasn't really capable of thinking deeper about the garbage bags or the lack of barking and talking while she was tied up in the kitchen, or the origin of the horrendous noises coming from the bathroom for the past few hours. She was attempting to formulate an exit strategy as a kidnapped 13-year-old. And that's a hell of a lot to ask of a teenager. Sarah took the opportunity to look around and could tell fairly quickly that they had parked in the parking lot of the Pipesville Road baseball fields. Cody often played at those diamonds. She couldn't stand to think about him too much at the moment. Focusing on survival was all she had. She didn't have time for more thoughts because Hoffman came storming back and yelled, "I told you I was watching!" He then tightened her blindfold and told her he'd kill her if she did anything else. Trusting that his warning would be enough, Hoffman took off cross-country for a jog to pick up his Toyota Yaris from a parking lot near the Kokosing Gap trailhead. Similar to when he, quote, borrowed his friend's pickup in Colorado, Hoffman tended to treat cars as free-to-use tools, to be used and swapped at his leisure. He returned with his Yaris, loaded Sarah into the car, and left behind the stolen Jeep and bags full of body parts. He had plans for those later. After a short drive, Hoffman pulled into a darkened back alley, checked and double-checked that no one was around, then carried Sarah into his house. When he removed her blindfold, Sarah was treated to a dingy white bathroom covered in perplexing doodles, a tree-trimming truck, a smiling man wearing a yin-yang shirt, a giant peace sign with the word peach in front of it, and an uncomfortable-looking bald man drawn around the faucet with his mouth wide open so the faucet stuck out of it above the sink. If it hadn't been clear to Sarah already, this moment cemented the idea that she was not dealing with a sane or reasoning individual. While she was looking around stunned, Hoffman tied her up with a rope and duct tape, told her that she would be watched by his accomplice, and they would kill her if she attempted to escape. He then gathered up his tree-climbing tools and left the house around midnight on November 10th. Aside from napping for a few hours in the woods across from the Herman household on the 9th, Hoffman hadn't slept for almost 24 hours, which was no doubt wreaking havoc on his already chaotic mental state. He stopped off at Walmart for a minute, grabbed a tarp, more garbage bags, a turkey sandwich, and a Halloween shirt that was on clearance for a dollar. He paid in cash. From there, Hoffman drove his Yaris to a canoe entrance a few miles from where he parked the Jeep. He then walked, carrying the tarp, the climbing tools, and the garbage bags. If anyone was wondering, he left the Halloween shirt behind in the car.
I mean, it was only a dollar.
Yeah.
So that's fine.
It's a random addition. It took him nearly 2 hours to reach the Jeep where he parked it, back by the baseball complex. Now, his real work began. Hoffman trekked the garbage bags full of human bodies and bones, all taken apart at the joints, out up into a massive birch tree tucked away near the Kokosing Gap Nature Trail. He had noticed it in his wanderings. He even climbed it and found an interesting quirk in its anatomy. About 40 feet off the ground, the tree split and opened up, creating a natural hollow that descended into the trunk as far as Hoffman could see with a flashlight. This was the place. Hoffman felt no one would ever find the bodies if he hid them here. His truest friends, the trees, would conceal his crimes and protect him from consequences. So around 3 a.m. on November 11th, Hoffman began the process of loading the garbage bags back and forth from the Jeep to the hollow tree. This, like everything else in Hoffman's plan, took much longer than he anticipated. The turkey sandwich no doubt helped keep him on his feet, but he was well past 24 hours without sleep. He had murdered and dismembered three people plus a dog, and he had unexpectedly taken a hostage. With his grisly cargo secured in its secret tree, Hoffman headed back to the Herman house for one last errand. He parked the stolen Jeep and stole Tina Herman's truck, intending to take it to a gas station to fill a few gas cans for another round of arson. However, this is where his addled mind began to make even more mistakes. First of all, he left the tarp and the extra garbage bags from Walmart in the garage. Second, and most importantly, he never made it back to the house with gasoline. The truck was in rough shape. It kept slipping out of gear and jouncing to a stop. Hoffman got nervous that he could get pulled over if it kept bouncing on the street, so he left the pickup in a parking lot and walked the rest of the way to his Toyota. That turned into a 3-hour walk. By the time he got back to his car, the sun was starting to brighten the eastern sky, and Hoffman was completely wiped out. Little food and less sleep was causing his judgment, as it were, to slip. He decided to catch a nap before returning to burn down the house. Back at Hoffman's house, Sarah had slept off and on for the last few hours, but not well. After all, she was tightly wrapped in duct tape and rope on the floor of his bathroom. Given no other options, she had peed in her pants a couple of times. Also, she was terribly hungry. When she heard Hoffman fiddling with the front door, she decided her best course of action, if she wanted a chance of survival, was to make Hoffman believe she was his 4 bags of leaves. Grocery bags and garbage bags, stuffed full and taped or tied shut. Bags taped to the walls all the way to the ceiling. Piles of leaves shuffled and crunched as Hoffman carried Sarah downstairs. Downstairs was the worst. Down in the unfinished cement basement, a giant mound of leaves spread to the walls. Exposed pipes were rusting in the ceiling. Spider webs and scuttling sounds surrounded Sarah as Hoffman placed her in the leaf pile and laid a blanket over her. Sarah asked why there were so many leaves around, and Hoffman replied, quote, "I use them to keep the house warm, their insulation." She asked if he had killed her brother and her mom. Hoffman said no. She asked about her dog, and Hoffman said, "I let it out of the house."
So why can't he be honest about it?
It's so weird. I think there's clearly some detachment from his actions, and these are the thoughts.
Yeah, because he clearly doesn't
psychopath.
Belong, yeah, he doesn't believe in consequences. Obviously, right? I mean,
believe or understand or even comprehend. Or, yeah,
maybe comprehension is maybe better, but. And
the things the he leaves. Lies about are just so inane. They're so like irrelevant. It's just really strange. And it's a weird way to like let it out of the house.
And the leaves, like, I mean, I know the trees are his friends, but like, is this a bit of a schizophrenic? I mean, obviously I'm not going to diagnose him, but like,
he was considered for schizophrenia later and came up not. No longer able to ignore her hunger, Sarah asked Hoffman if she could have something to eat. He said, quote, "I have some dead squirrels in the freezer. Want me to cook one for you?" Sarah did not want him to cook one for her.
I don't know why.
Yeah.
I mean,
she wasn't down for the squirrel barbecue. Eventually, he did give her a bowl of cereal with sour, lumpy milk.
Oh.
Poor Sarah horked it down as best she could, knowing it might be her only opportunity to eat. At some point in the evening, Hoffman fashioned Sarah a diaper out of garbage bag and wrapped it around the outside of Sarah's pants. Exhausted, Hoffman climbed upstairs and passed out on his couch. Sarah laid on a bed of leaves in the pitch black basement covered with a ratty blanket, alerted by every scuffle and papery click of the leaves, a single question playing over and over in her mind. How am I going to get out of this? When Tina Herman didn't show up for work for a second day, Valerie Haythorne, her manager at DQ, called the sheriff's office again. They had also recently been informed that Cody and Sarah were both absent from school. When Haythorne called one more time to inform them that Tina's best friend, Stephanie Sprang, was also missing, the sheriff decided to do a welfare check at both homes just to see what they could see. After all, circumstance and gut feelings wouldn't lead to a warrant to search either house, and that's all they had.
Well, and
that's all they can do.
And there was no obvious sign of struggle or correct. Anything like that. Nothing that showed anything out of the ordinary. So that is all they could do.
Yep. Yeah. Nothing indicated that anybody was in mm-hmm. danger.
Right.
Aside, they're just missing. So the welfare checks again didn't find anything suspicious. Haythorne felt otherwise, and she couldn't shake that feeling. She called Sprang's boyfriend, Ron Metcalf, and the two of them agreed to meet at Tina's place that afternoon to do their own checking. That's a good friend. After oh, for all, sure. while the police were hamstrung by the legal strictures, friends don't have those limits. Haythorne and Metcalf met outside Tina's place around 4 p.m. on November 11th. The two chatted briefly, then decided to have Haythorne climb through a rear window and check out the house. Once inside, Haythorne saw the bloodbath that Hoffman had left behind. Blood spattered across walls and carpets, large, darkening pools of blood in various areas of the home, and a series of bloody drag marks leading to the bathroom. She immediately exited the house and contacted the sheriff's department again. Detectives were dispatched to the scene. Crime tape was wound around the house, and the investigation into the disappearance of Tina Herman, her children, and their dog, and her best friend finally began. While officers worked to secure a warrant, Greg Borders finally showed up. A neighbor had called and informed him there were cops outside of his house, so he rushed back to Mount Vernon from his friend's place a few hours away. He signed a permission to search form immediately and explained where he had been the past couple of days. The police looked him over for defensive wounds, checked out his alibi, and he was quickly released as a suspect. Warrant in hand, as well as the permission, the police entered the Herman residence. They finally understood why Valerie Haythorne had been so adamant about having police check on her friend and employee. The horror show of blood, brain, and human flesh mixed with splatters of motor oil that Hoffman had intended to use to burn the house led the police to immediately call the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Identification and Investigation. After all, BCI agents specialized in crime scene processing and analysis. Across town, Hoffman awakened from his exhausted sleep, knowing he had precious little time to get back to the Herman house to start the fire. He checked on Sarah to make sure she was still tightly bound and left his house around 6 p.m. on November 11th. His plan was to return to the pickup he had stolen, collect the gas cans he purchased, fill them, and go burn the house down. But, like so many of Hoffman's decisions surrounding the murders, this one was just terribly bad for him. It just so happened that a sheriff's deputy out on patrol noticed the blue pickup parked where Hoffman left it. The deputy remembered that a blue pickup was seen in the driveway at the Herman house the previous day, so he parked and he peeked around the lot. In an adjacent lot that was closed after dark, the deputy noticed a silver Toyota Yaris with a man behind the wheel. It was parked with its lights off. Hoffman and the deputy had just happened to approach the blue pickup at practically the same time. The deputy walked over to where Hoffman was parked and asked for his license and registration. As he handed them over, Hoffman claimed he was waiting for his girlfriend, Sarah. You know, the 13-year-old girlfriend he had tied up and duct tape in his leaf-covered nightmare basement? That, Sarah. The deputy asked Hoffman if he lived near King Beach Drive, where the Herman House was located. Hoffman explained that his mother lived over there, but he lived across town. The deputy informed Hoffman that the parking lot was closed after dark. He returned to his patrol car, and Hoffman scooted away in the Yaris. That's frustrating.
What could he have done, though? Could he have done anything different?
No.
Differently?
No.
No.
No. It's so, like, we have all the information.
We know the information.
I mean, it's all weird and it's all happenstance, but nothing wrong has occurred here.
Right.
So.
Just this fucking weird guy in a parking lot waiting for his girlfriend, Sarah.
Yeah.
The deputy doesn't know that it's a, you know.
Ugh. As he drove home, Hoffman tried to figure out how he could still burn the house down if the police knew about it. He also started getting nervous about the sleeping bag and various camping implements he left in the woods across the street from Herman's house. Hoffman returned home, a thousand eventualities spinning through his incoherent mind. When Hoffman returned, he went to the basement to visit Sarah. When he went downstairs to visit, he would just stand there and stare, ignoring Sarah's questions. The terrified 13-year-old girl shivering on bed of leaves before him. While BCI agents processed the gory scene at the Herman House across town, Hoffman drank a bottle of wine at his place, made a bonfire, and burned the shoes he wore during the murders. After a brief wine nap, Hoffman went downstairs, stared at Sarah for a few more minutes, then strapped his mountain bike to his Yaris and left to get his camping gear back from his spot in the woods before police found it.
You would think that he would have more compassion for his friends, the trees, like he's the Lorax or something over here. And he's having a bonfire. So, I mean, this guy has absolutely no empathy for, I mean, obviously not the trees. That's not what I mean. Or the wood, but like just zero empathy. His idea of visiting is just staring like a creep.
Like, and I met, like, he was probably staring there and having his own delusional conversation and interaction while this poor girl just stood up there and looked at him horrifically. Like, what little detachment he had in those moments. It's impossible for us to even understand. His brain just doesn't work like any of ours. Mm-hmm. So it was just past midnight on November 12th when he left. Hoffman ditched his bike a few miles from the crime scene and walked slowly through the woods to avoid drawing attention. It took him several hours, but he was relieved to find, when he arrived at his primitive campsite, that nothing had been moved since he left it there 2 days ago. He collected a hat and a knife, but oddly, left other objects behind. He also stuck around to watch police work for a little bit. He had often spied on people from the tree branches where he liked to spend his time, but this was something different. The stakes were so much higher. He hated to peel himself away from his handiwork, but Hoffman had a long walk back to his bike, then a long ride back to his car. By the time he returned home, it was just after 9 a.m. Meanwhile, BCI agents were processing shoe imprints left in blood and motor oil throughout the house. Based on one of the prints they found and compared to the shoes in Sarah's closet, the agents were able to deduce that someone with Sarah's shoe size walked or was forced through the house on foot to the garage. Greg Borders called and asked Tina's ex-husband, Larry Maynard, where Tina and the kids were. Larry lived about 50 miles away with his new wife, Tracy. The two men had never been on good terms, and while Greg had no idea what actually happened, he was immediately suspicious of Larry. The two snapped back and forth at each other until Larry hung up on Greg. Aside from the pointless personal finger-pointing, the case was beginning to expand in scope and in media attention. The FBI got involved, and various national news outlets were sniffing around about the story. Four people disappearing in a city of 35,000 where just one homicide was reported in the previous year? This was the kind of small town gone wrong story that Dateline was made for. While the crime scene became increasingly chaotic and full of law enforcement officials tripping over one another, Hoffman's house continued to be a morose den of rustling leaves and uncomfortable silence. Sarah continued to ask questions and attempt to ingratiate herself to Hoffman. Her mental rallying cry was, quote, whatever it takes to survive. Unfortunately for Sarah, Hoffman was about to push that rallying cry to its limits. Despite the fact that she had been marinating in her own urine for the past several days, Hoffman sexually assaulted Sarah at least once, then left her to shiver in the darkness of the basement. She was now entering the third day of captivity. She had been given rotten milk and cereal, a bed of leaves in a cement basement, and a traumatic sexual assault. But she was alive. So far, Sarah had been successful in her bid for survival. While Sarah languished in Hoffman's basement, police were hard at work piecing together the many clues left behind at the crime scene. The garbage bags that Hoffman inexplicably left at the house were traceable to Walmart through their barcodes. And while Hoffman paid in cash, police were able to procure the security tapes and identify one and only one possible suspect. A white male wearing a camouflage shirt, carrying garbage bags, some tarps, a turkey sandwich, and a discount Halloween shirt to a silver Yaris in the parking lot. Living in a smaller city like Mount Vernon meant that only so many people in the area owned a silver Toyota Yaris. It didn't take much work to look up Hoffman's driver's license photo and find out that the Yaris was registered under his name. Coincidentally, Hoffman happened to be wearing the same shirt in his driver's license picture that he wore to Walmart that night. What are the odds of that? Once they had Hoffman's picture and the Yaris connection, the detectives discovered that an officer on patrol made contact with Hoffman 2 days prior. The officer described the conversation, how Hoffman sat in his silver Yaris barely 100 yards from the pickup he stole, and how he said he was going to meet his girlfriend, Sarah. The detectives searched for Hoffman in their database and found a domestic violence call from late October involving Hoffman and his then-girlfriend at his home address, 49 Columbus Road. Even without searching his house, the evidence was beginning to pile up against Hoffman. In the early hours of November 14th, detectives requested a search warrant for Hoffman's home, and it was immediately approved by the county prosecutor and a local judge. A SWAT team was assembled and the police headed over to exercise a no-knock warrant on Hoffman's residence. Of course, that means they blasted the door down with a ram, tossed in a flashbang, and swarmed the house from every direction. Hoffman, fast asleep on his couch, was easily apprehended and escorted out. The SWAT team found an out-of-commission marijuana grow room upstairs, as well as bags upon bags upon bags of leaves in every room. They kicked through loose leaves until they found a cabinet that blocked a doorway to the basement. So the basement door was actually somewhat concealed. The team proceeded gingerly down the stairs, still on high alert for any accomplices that might be in the house. As they reached the bottom of the stairs and started rifling through more leaves, a rustling sound caused the team to train their flashlights and guns on young Sarah Herman, still duct tape and bound and wearing a garbage bag for a diaper. Until Sarah noticed the helmets and the officers, she had no idea that she was being rescued. 3 days in almost total darkness with no water, very little food, constantly at the mercy of a mentally unstable man who killed her mom, her brother, and her mom's best friend had completely eroded her ability to trust. Before the officers could free her, they had to take pictures of her bonds in the room where Hoffman kept her. When she was finally freed and lifted to her feet, her first words, "I have to get to school."
Because that poor baby was in shock.
Yeah, it's a dissociative coping mechanism that people will do in moments of intense stress and trauma and shock. She had been abducted and sexually assaulted, and her family was murdered. But that sort of trauma, very, very, very difficult to process, especially in her state. All her brain could handle in that moment was to default to the usual teenage worry, school. Sarah was accompanied by a special agent who interviewed her on the way to the hospital. She gave all the information she could remember from the initial dodge of Hoffman when he charged her at the front door, up to the moment the SWAT team arrived. While her sense of time was, of course, skewed by the days she spent in a pitch-black basement, the details she provided about Hoffman's behavior and whereabouts were invaluable. At the hospital, doctors treated a cut on Sarah's finger and took samples for a sexual assault kit. And I'm guessing hospital food never tasted so good as it did to Sarah that day. When Larry Maynard, her father, got the call that his daughter was found alive and well and was being treated at a local hospital, he raced to her side. The two hugged and cried and tried not to think about the other side of Sarah's survival. Nothing had been said or implied about Tina or Cody. Still, they had each other, and that had to be celebrated. BCI agents got to work cataloging and processing the evidence from Hoffman's house. They quickly found the knife and blackjack used in the murders. Although they had no way of knowing those were murder weapons without finding the bodies. That was one place where Hoffman had been exceptionally cautious. The hollow tree where he stashed the garbage bags full of Tina, Stephanie, Cody, and the family dog was not just in a remote place. It was also inaccessible from anywhere outside of a small hole 40 feet off the ground. No one would know that the tree even had an opening unless they were a park ranger or a murderer with dendrophilia. Hoffman was held on charges of kidnapping, but officers knew they were dealing with something much darker. Agents hoped they could pull some incriminating information from Hoffman through questioning. They wanted anything that could definitively link him to the chaos of blood and missing people at the Herman house. What they got, at least initially, was total silence. For 3 hours, detectives attempted to get any sort of response from Hoffman, but to no avail. At one point, in response to their questions, he made a series of hand gestures like sign language to indicate he had a broken heart. But other than that, he sat there, silent as the grave. Sometimes he put his head down. Sometimes he cried. Sometimes he yawned. But he didn't utter a single word for 3 hours. Eventually, a BCI special agent got Hoffman to say that he was having a hard time figuring out what happened, and that he had simply found Sarah in his house, duct tape and bound with rope. That led him to believe he hadn't done anything wrong. And I'm guessing the police thought, hey, yeah, samesies, you definitely have done something wrong here. He then followed up this baffling statement by saying he took good care of Sarah after she appeared in his house. Then he went silent for another hour, and the officers stopped questioning for the day. It's an exercise in frustration. Dozens of phone calls took over the line at Larry Maynard's house where Sarah was recovering and trying to find a little peace after her ordeal. Talk shows and national news organizations were tripping over themselves to get access to the teenage girl who survived. Hoffman, meanwhile, still wasn't talking, despite different tactics attempted by agents. They took him for a drive around various areas to see if anything could elicit a response, and they got nothing. The next day, things got a little surreal. On November 15th, two BCI agents, Joe Dietz and Kristen Cadu, met and prepared to interrogate Hoffman for the third time in 2 days. However, before they entered the room, Hoffman asked if he could talk to Dietz privately. The two entered the interview room. Hoffman asked if Dietz could turn off all audio and video recording, and Dietz complied, feeling a change in Hoffman's mood. The fact that he was talking at all was exciting. Then Hoffman asked if he could be escorted to the restroom. Once in the restroom, Hoffman asked Dietz to hand his cell phones or any other recording device to the officer posted outside. Dietz complied. Again, finally, Hoffman made a statement that was odd, even for him. He told Dietz he had a dream last night that he worked in a meat processing plant. In the dream, he opened a garbage bag and saw human body parts inside. He informed Dietz that details were starting to return to him, but he wanted to reveal them in the absolute weirdest way.
Wait, so he claimed that he wanted to reveal them that way?
Yep. Like, he told Dietz, hey, these details are starting to return to me. And then he's like, but there's a certain way I want to tell them to you. So Hoffman told Dietz that he wanted to write down the location of the bodies and have an attorney write up a legal document stating that that paper, telling where the bodies were, would only be released to police after Hoffman's death.
No. You don't get to do that.
Well, he's trying to make the rules, Don. It's a little strange. But the next bit is even more weird. Hoffman then, after he gave this confession or whatever to the attorney, after that he told Dietz, then I want to take another ride around town with the police. But this time, I will, quote, pretend to escape, and then I want you to shoot and kill me. After I'm dead, the attorney will reveal the location of the bodies. He said he couldn't live with what he had done, and he planned to kill himself in jail anyway because he didn't want to be on antipsychotic meds for the rest of his life.
I mean, so...
What do you think? The cop's going to take the deal?
Fucking shoot him for free, but...
In the 70s, like, they might have taken this deal.
I know, but also... Time. But how kind of him to say, hey, you know what? Can you get rid of all recording devices? I don't want you to get in trouble for this.
So there's...
Because he thinks somebody's going to take him up on this.
Yeah. No, he legitimately believes this is possible.
And like, this is a really good idea.
Great idea.
Yeah.
And it's a great idea with a number of logical leaps happening that I don't think we can... I think we can just gloss over with one simple statement. Hoffman had absolutely no idea what to do next. And so Dietz attempted to talk him out of his suicidal state. And then Hoffman broke down and said, quote, I'm a monster and I can't live with what I've done. Dietz kept pushing to get him to give some small clue about where the bodies were, but Hoffman clammed up again, claiming he was lying about remembering where the bodies were. The interview concluded, and Hoffman went to a hearing where a judge set bail at $1 million. While they were getting nothing from Hoffman, interviewing some of Stephanie Sprang's friends unearthed a possible connection between him and Sprang. Turns out Sprang's ex-husband, Mike, put an addition on Hoffman's house a few years ago. That, and Sprang may have cleaned his house a couple of times, probably before the whole leaf collecting thing. Up to this point, it looked like a completely random crime. Now, this was a very thin connection, but at least it started to make sense, possibly, how Hoffman chose his victims. On November 16th, just short of a week after the murders and Sarah's abduction, agents wrapped up evidence collection at Herman's house. Finally, Larry Maynard could get into his ex-wife's house to grab some valuables. He was warned before he entered that after he saw what the house looked like, he wouldn't have any questions about what happened to Tina, Cody, and Stephanie. Once Larry saw blood in every room, the pools and spatter, he knew his family was gone, and his hope of finding them alive, decimated. He gathered up some clothes for Sarah, and then sat in Cody's room and cried. Hoffman's interviews were still exercises in frustration for agents. While he had previously expressed a desire to die, Hoffman changed direction abruptly when his public defender told him they could get the death penalty taken off the table if he told agents where the bodies were located. He agreed to plead guilty to everything they put on the table: aggravated murder, burglary, tampering with evidence, abuse of a corpse, kidnapping, and sexual assault. He would need to write out a formal confession as well as agree to answer, in writing, a series of questions submitted by the sheriff's office. Finally, his lawyer would have to accept the state of Ohio's recommendation of a life sentence without possibility of parole. Larry Maynard signed off on the offer, and Hoffman began drawing up a map and describing the location of the bodies. Finally, the families would have some manner of closure. An answer, however terrible, is better than an infinite question. Officers and two assistant public defenders drove out to the Kokosing Wildlife Area and met up with a park ranger who immediately recognized the area on the map Hoffman made. As opposed to the incoherent madness of drawings in Hoffman's house, his map was direct and detailed. After a short hike, the officers found a 70-foot-tall birch tree that fit Hoffman's description. They could even see the opening to the hollow where he said he stowed the garbage bags. Utilizing a small hole about 7 feet up the trunk, the officers looked in and saw a pile of wood chips, as well as a few discernible garbage bags that matched the ones Hoffman had left behind at the Herman house. Using a chainsaw, officers cut a square hole into the trunk of the birch tree and began the unenviable task of removing numerous garbage bags and inspecting their contents. Inside, they found the heads of Tina Herman, Cody Maynard, and Stephanie Sprang in one bag, a dissected dog in another, and torsos with vicious stab wounds, each sealed individually. Arms, legs, some bloody clothing, and blood-soaked towels filled the other bags. Once they were finished taking out the bags, the tree was slated for removal. The police didn't want it becoming some sort of macabre shrine to Hoffman. Now, I'm not going to describe in gruesome detail what the coroners found during their examination. It is simply too savage. But suffice to say, through what was left of the bodies, they were able to identify and trace the hemorrhages that matched the blackjack, as well as the knife wounds in each of the body, to the murder weapon. And it was damning evidence against Hoffman that associated the murder weapon. Hoffman's written confession got the broad strokes of the murders correct, though his details were inconsistent and in many cases didn't match what Sarah said or what the evidence showed. He wrote about, quote, processing the bodies, about packing them into bags, and about kidnapping Sarah. However, he painted himself as having an understanding with Sarah and said he untied her and shared McDonald's with her on the first night of her abduction. He claimed that he, quote, took care of her by making her a diaper and letting her shower, which Sarah said was untrue. He also said they watched movies together and that he let her sleep untied because he slept with his arms around her. Both of these were lies. Along with many other lies and half-truths, Hoffman claimed the two watched porno together and had, quote, consensual oral sex. Now, I don't know if in his mind that somehow made the statutory rape acceptable, but
or the actual rape?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, the actual rape, but he continued to offer up qualifiers and explanations for every statement he made. His confession, air quotes, in other words, was full of rationalization and self-defense. He even claimed that he only, quote, processed the bodies to make their disposal easier, and that he hadn't wanted to kill anyone. But Stephanie Sprang had started yelling at him, and things just spiraled out of his control. It seemed more and more like Hoffman either didn't have a complete grasp on reality, or he was just an expert liar. His lies were not given in a way that would exonerate him from his crimes. Instead, they were just sprinkled throughout his story, pertinent to nothing. After his confession and a second search of his house, the charges against Hoffman were modified. And this is actually why it is somewhat important to include the brutalization of the bodies, because after the fact, he was also added tampering with evidence and then three additional counts of abuse of a corpse. In January, a grand jury convened and, after 6 hours of testimony, found Matthew Hoffman guilty of all charges. He was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole in Toledo Correctional Institution in Ohio, where he remains to this day.
Wait, wouldn't a grand jury be deciding if they can charge him or not, or is it just a jury?
No, he was found guilty, yeah. A grand jury convened, and after, they found him guilty immediately.
Okay.
He was sentenced to life in prison, and Larry and Sarah Maynard were there to watch him be escorted away to spend the rest of his life in a box. Matthew Hoffman, he doesn't see the world the way that we do. And not in like a cute, I think birds aren't real or the earth is flat kind of way. He is completely disconnected from reality and society. And that disconnection carried a sinister edge that no one who met him ever imagined or ever fathomed. The horrific nature of his crimes, the absent-minded way he left behind evidence, and the strange, abject silence that accompanied his police interviews all add up to a person who does not live or think on the same plane of existence as most people. And now, because of savvy police work and a young girl's unbending will to survive, he will have the rest of his life to live inside the dark, alien world inside his mind. Sarah Maynard is alive and well, living a quiet life under an assumed name, processing a secret horror that people around her will never know or understand.
Wow.
Sources, the peopleofhistory.com and onthisday.com for the timeline. The book, The Girl in the Leaves, written by Robert Scott, that was released in 2012. The YouTube documentary, Explore With Us, Matthew's Bizarre House of Horrors. This episode of Midwest Murder was written by Tyler Hancock, edited and produced by Jonah Lanto with the Good Talk Network. It's co-hosted by Don Palumbo and myself. And we're damn glad to be here, Williston. Thank you so much.
Big thank you to everybody here. And of course, another big thank you to Sarah Schroeder for sponsoring this event and episode.
Couldn't do it without her. Thank you, Williston.
Thanks.